Welcome to another Explorer Tape, as presented by the Monroe Institute of Applied Sciences. This particular session is different, as you will quickly note, and is a result of many requests from Institute members. The material itself is taken from several sessions, in all of which the Explorer was reporting from full physical waking states of consciousness, and in his physical body. At least it is presumed that he was. No electrodes were attached to him at the time, thus there is no verification of his exact state. He was not in an isolation chamber, nor was he in the usual lying down mode. Instead, he was usually sitting in a near lotus position on the floor, or standing, or slouched in a chair. The location, the main meeting room in the Institute Center in Virginia, at bedtime story sessions during the Gateway Voyage program. The Explorer? Well, I hope he is familiar to you by this time.
It's been over 10 years since you wrote the book. What have you been doing since then?
Well, in looking back, I kind of wonder myself what I've been doing the last 10 years or so. Sometimes I think it's nothing. Other times I say, well, what has been happening? Well, first of all, the publication of the book attracted a lot of attention and gave me the opportunity to meet a lot of new people, which was very rewarding in itself. I think the other part is that I came out of the closet instead of being a closet, out-of-body, hidden-away person. I became known generally that this thing has been taking place in my life, or had been. And it was funny that I began to be looked upon as sort of people would stare and look at me and say, is that who he is? That's that person that goes out of their body and is these strange looks, like he's a weirdo or a freak or something. But it was a lot of fun and to see this change. And, of course, one of the most rewarding things that has taken place in the last 10 years is the mail of people from, say, all over the world, different types of mail, and the most important ones were the ones that said, thank God I know I'm sane, instead of being some particular type of person who has a mental aberration that they were hiding in the closet, I might add. So that was, that's sort of a general approach, and of course, the other part is that in these last 10 years, there's been a very amazing change in the way people think. And, of course, I like to think that this book had something to do with it. And, as I said, coming out of the closet by necessity, having written the book, the immense changes over these last 10 or 11 years in public attitude. And one of the things that has taken place, of course, is that now it's okay to talk about out-of-body experiences as a reality. And from that point of view, we participated in the presentation last year of three papers before the American Psychiatric Association on the out-of-body experiences, which 10 years ago would be an unheard-of thing. It was beyond my wildest imagination that the APA would seriously listen to a phenomenon known as the out-of-body experience. And there's been a lot of other things. I've given lectures in the last 10 years? 100, 200, 500? I haven't counted them. But one of them I gave at the Smithsonian Institute, institution in Washington, and that's beyond my wildest dreams 10 years ago, that of such a conservative place that one would give a talk on the out-of-body experiences. And during the talk, I noticed that he was given in this auditorium off one of the main halls, and outside in one of these display halls was a wire, an invisible sort of wire coming down from the ceiling, and there was nothing on the end of the wire. So in that particular talk, I referred to this wire with nothing on the end of it, and I said, there is the Smithsonian display of someone in their out-of-body state. You can't see it, but there it is. But this is kind of the fun things that have happened. And one of the other things that has developed through the years is it, and these things I speak of are references to it, that more and more I think the acceptance of the fact that the out-of-body state is a natural state. It's not a weird type thing. It's something that we, of course, believe now takes place during everyone's sleep at night. And perhaps in the next 10 years to come, this will be scientifically proven. And one way or another, perhaps we may have a part of that. And if so, what happens during sleep that causes one to leave their body? And that, of course, is something will be a product of the information of that may be come out in subsequent research. But that's what's happened since then. Well, I think perhaps the most important thing also in the last 10 years that we formally set together this institute that had been sort of a planned thing for some 10 years prior to then. I think it was probably formed or officially formed out of necessity simply because of the input of interested parties as a result of the book. But originally what was the origin of the institute was the R&D division of a company that I had some, oh goodness, 20 years ago, I guess it was. And in those 20 years, then the 10 years prior to the publication of the book, this was my own company, and so it had to do with audio systems, so it was quite proper that that company researched audio techniques. And among those things, in looking for those audio techniques, it's often been a question as to which came first, the chicken or the egg, the audio research as to out-of-body or the previous audio research creating the out-of-body state in me. But that's another matter. Anyway, that's what did happen in these last 10 years was the organization, the formalization of the Institute as an offshoot or a follow-up to this original research that had been done by the company that I had. And as a result, within these last 10 years, we have developed certain interesting things that have borne fruit. The first of those was we did develop a technique of audio pulsing called, we call it a method of evoking a frequency following response in the brain through audio pulses. And we did obtain a basic patent on that particular method back in 1975, and that's some years ago already. And beyond that, we did develop a pattern from that formula or that method. We did develop this what we call hemispheric synchronization, which we are still not sure is a natural state, but it is a different state of consciousness, and we have been exploring that ever since. Is this beginning to help answer your question a little bit? I know I'm getting off the track.
No, you're filling in lots of
time. All right. One of the other things that did take place was that I guess this must have been 4 years ago. Four, five. Always lose a year, so I'll add another year. We were invited out to a place called Esalen in California, and you may have heard of it. Esalen is in the past anyway, has been sort of the hotbed or origin point for many different types of psychological and psychiatric and philosophies as to the mind and how the mind works and many things like that have originated with some type of Esalen presentation or Esalen program. And Esalen is out at Big Sur, and it's right on the edge of a cliff overlooking the Pacific Ocean. Anyway, they had heard of our researchers, the people who operate Esalen, and invited us to do a weekend program at Esalen at Big Sur, and which gathering together the methods that we had developed and put them into a workshop program, which we did. And this friend of mine, who is no longer here at the, not at the Institute, he's no longer around in time space, but he joined me, and we, two really initiates in the methods of putting together workshops, stumbled out to Big Sur, California with a suitcase full of tapes, and we were not using headphones at that particular time. Anyway, we had a method where we were on a round-the-clock tape program where people slept for an hour and a half, and then we'd have a tape and sleep for another hour and a half. But we never did realize until we got there and did it that somebody had to run the show for that hour and a half, for that 36 or 48 hours. And here, at the end of it, he was exhausted and I was exhausted. So we never really did know the results with the participants. We were just too tired to find out. We both disappeared into hotels in San Francisco and collapsed for 2 days because it was just really a rough one. Anyway.
That would almost be called a right brain exercise.
It was. It was a lesson in something. But in any event, this one man who had been in the program knew where I was sleeping. And he's a physicist out at one of the big think tanks in California. And he called me Tuesday afternoon and woke me up. And he says, "I'm sorry to wake you up." And I says, "Well, you did." And so he said, "I have tried this one technique 58 times, being that research physicist type that he is. And he says, it has worked 52 times, and I can't verify the other four." And he says, "What do I do next?" He says, "I don't know," because we had just started this thing. The other facet of it was that we were due to do a similar program. We'd already, because Eslin in San Francisco had heard about this particular thing taking place out of Big Sur, and they said, "Well, me too." So we had stupidly agreed to do the next weekend another one immediately following in San Francisco, and we both groaned mightily because of what was going to happen that next weekend. And we had learned one thing, but we didn't know how to solve it, was that that particular thing we were doing at the time made these participants ravenous with hunger, and it's still a mystery because it was only peculiar to that particular program. And so at Big Sur, we had the kitchen was right next door, and we had the principle of ongoing food. Whenever they needed, they'd go in the kitchen, here's piles of food, then they would eat. We even didn't have any formal meals. We just did it that way. Whenever they're hungry, there's food. So the place where it was in San Francisco, I immediately sensed trouble because it was up on the fourth floor of a walk-up on Union Street in San Francisco, and an office building was the top floor. And the problem seemed to be developing because the food was going to be catered in there instead of being available. Well, anyway, the first day worked all right, but on Sunday morning, all these people at 5 o'clock were wide awake and ravenous. Where's the food? Where's the food? And went out on Union Street on a Sunday morning at 5 o'clock. There's no place open for food or anything. These are all sort of fancy restaurants, and you can't get anything open. And we're waiting for the caterer to come in, and there were these outside steps that went up to the top of the building. And this is about 30 people waiting to be fed, and it is now about 6 o'clock, and the man was supposed to be there at 6, and so it wasn't his fault. But when he opened the door and these people came in with these trays, they just descended on him like a bunch of locusts and grabbed the food and wolfed it. And he looked, the funniest look on this man's face, to see these people grabbing buns, you know, chomp, 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 and eating the buns. So anyway, whatever we changed the program to be after that, it didn't work quite the same way, this tremendous hunger. We never did understand why the hunger was created.
It still does exist.
I think so, too, because at the Gateway programs, it's incredible. Like, having been a participant in two of them, mm-hmm. I can't believe the amount of food that I personally consumed and everybody else.
And you do not gain weight. That's what's fascinating.
You must be
just utilizing an incredible amount of energy.
Well, that was the origin of the Gateway program, incidentally, and that's how it started, was that after that, the word spread, and all of a sudden we had requests to do another one, and I think we probably did the next one out in California, and we continued to do them out in California, and then some people in Kansas heard about it, and we had to go do one in Kansas. And it was beginning to get something, so we finally said, well, what do we call this thing? So we called it very grandiosely the M5000 program, saying that this is a good way to conduct ongoing research. And we got teased about the fact that we're the only research outfit whose volunteers get charged for the privilege of being volunteers.
The only one in the world.
And so anyway, that's how it evolved, and we got tired of the M5000, realizing it'd take quite a while to reach 5,000. Our idea was to have 5,000 participants, that we'd have a good scale and measure the results. So somewhere along the way, we got lost in computerism and said this is not going to work, and so we changed it over the name to the Gateway Program for very obvious reasons. But that pretty much is what has been happening in the last pattern. The most important thing, I suppose, that is generally asked, and when people ask that question, is what am I doing in the out-of-body state after 10 years, or what's happening in the out-of-body state? Well, one of the things is that something must have happened 5 years ago, but some 5 years ago I did make a decision. I made the decision that this consciousness, this time-space consciousness that I'm using right now, did not have enough knowledge, enough experience to really handle the out-of-body state as I understood it. In other words, what to do with it. Because by 5 years ago, when I had gotten extremely tired of the experimental mode of making runs from Virginia to California, for example, and how many times can you do this before it gets extremely boring, or more importantly, you're using a medium in an environment that it doesn't feel like belonging in, and as it were. In the out-of-body state, time-space is kind of a gray area, and up here above you somehow is a very, very beautiful glowing lights that attract you immeasurably. And once you go to those glowing lights, it's very, very difficult to stay down in and perform mundane experimentation in this gray, murky area.
Such as going from Virginia to San Francisco.
Such as going from Virginia to San Francisco. And it sounds very mundane, or what's the word, to say that it is boring, but it does get boring, because you're looking up and there's the fun up there, and you're having to go plowing through this. And I very much got to the state that I could no longer resist the bright lights, and I found going to the bright lights stretched this consciousness so far to be able to perceive and understand it, or even know what to do when I got there, that I made this decision. And the decision was fundamentally this, that instead of my having this time-space consciousness direct what my out-of-body state will be and what I will do with it, I will let my total self make this decision. So about 5 or 6 years ago, I made this decision, and now when I go into the out-of-body state, fundamentally, and it's been going on for these 5 years, and an amazing change took place as a result, I simply roll pleasantly out of the body, and I say, all right, let's go. What is the menu for today, or what's the itinerary? And with that, this time-space consciousness sort of goes along for the ride, or as an objective observer, and not by far the decision-maker, as it were. And this total self, with a sort of paternal pat on the head, says, well, tonight's the night we do this. And so we go to one of these amazing, from this consciousness point of view, far off or seemingly far off, states of being, reality systems, and perform functions that totally bewilder this particular consciousness, this particular consciousness desperately tries to understand these actions and these reasons for performing these things, and which are virtually impossible to bring back to this reality, except for the tremendous acceleration of them, the tremendous sense of awe about some of the things being performed. And I suppose you'd like to know my interpretation of one of these things that being performed. As near as I can gather, the It is a group? Is it one of a whole? In other words, is this total I, is it a finger on a hand, on a body, that is performing this awesome function? And as near as I can understand, that awesome function is, it is comparable to setting up a whole solar system or a galaxy of that type of creative process. That and observing and participating in the manipulation of energies to do this. And coming home into this gray space is very mundane after getting into that type of thing. And as I say, from my perspective, I still don't know whether I'm a finger of a hand, of a body, of a total self that's doing this, or there are a group of us, because it's quite apparent there's another finger next to me that I'm coordinating with that has an energy system not quite like mine that is also needed to perform this function. Just as your thumb performs a different function than your forefinger, but they are somehow connected. And when you come back from one of those, it is that's one of the types of things that is so difficult to describe. And I've gotten lazy. I no longer go through a system to get into the out-of-body state. It is a nightly thing, but usually on a nightly thing, I go through two sleep cycles, wake up, and this is about 3 o'clock in the morning or something like that, thereabouts, depending on when I go to sleep. And I wake up and my body's totally relaxed. I'm rested. My mind is very alert. And to get out of the body at that stage is absurdly easy for me. It's a little neat sort of a detachment. You sort of sink down a little bit, come up and make a roll over, and you're out. And it's then at that stage, rolling out, I'm just there. I am. And if I after performing that function, I would just sort of roll or float in the air and just sort of float really, you know, a very gentle oscillation, and nothing would happen until this consciousness says, "Okay, where do we go now?" And a minute, and then this total self says, "Well, I thought you'd never ask." And that's when it begins. And re-entry from that is, or coming back, is I hope, and most of the time I have protective systems that don't call me back, like a telephone ringing or a cat jumping on the bed or something like that. But generally speaking, coming back is a very gentle thing, having performed that particular task or function during that particular segment, which is... It can be the equivalent of 1,000 years in activity, although it may only be 20 minutes in this time. So because it has no measurement in terms of time, and it seems like an eternity has taken place in activity. When I come back, I realize that the most it could have been is a half an hour. And re-entry into that is sort of a type thing, where, what? And I look at my usual clock time and say, only 20 minutes? And we built a few planets and a few moons and created a sun or two all in that 20 minutes. And that's where it is.
Question. Bob, mm-hmm. Do you always take your physical form in that sense, or do you use other forms to travel?
The best description I can give you on that is that in terms of moving into that type of energy system operation, I no longer have a physical form. I've become quite aware of it as a form.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you're a ball shaped, as near as I can figure, and if you need an arm, you grow an arm, as it were, very quickly, or you create an arm. If you can think of this, of an energy matrix, your physical body is a matrix like a jello mold, all right? And the jello is in the mold, and take the mold, and the jello gets out of the mold, and it still has the shape, just as this energy has the shape of a human body. But after that, after it's been out a while and, say, warmed, it sort of melts, and it loses the form of the jello, loses its form. And this energy, the farther you get away from your physical body, the more I perceive that it losing the, and farther is not the term at all, the more forgetful you be that you have a physical body, is a better way of putting it, the less that you resume or continue to have that humanoid form. You don't think of seeing with eyes and this kind of thing. But it is very much and I guess that is the proper term, the more you forget about having a physical body, the less you have the human form.
If you think about it, then, can you take the form of the ball or, say, a dolphin or...
Oh, yes, yeah.
That's mm-hmm. all it takes is thinking about
all
it.
All about that, the thinking about it...
makes it so?
Makes it so, pretty much. I have always wanted to try a dolphin, but I don't know, I haven't been lured into that yet. Although I have been playing around in the ocean stuff, but I never thought to take a dolphin form and see whether... a big female dolphin came up and said, "Hey, big boy," or something like this. But it's that kind of thing that has been the last 10 years. Obviously, the main thing in my life has been the formation of the Institute during that 10 years, and having completed more or less of a cycle in that form, and the Institute in itself is becoming far more diverse than simply the very... typical or not typical, good night, no, single-pointed organization conducting research, it is diverting into many, many different patterns, and that's what I see the next 10 years are about as regards the Institute. And what I do in the next 10 years, well, that is a good open question. Time to interrupt and turn your cassette over to continue on the other side.
What have come of your research effort in recent years?
Well, I hate to start with a negative, but if there's one thing that we've discovered, and that is that it is impossible with our present instrumentation to directly measure this life force, this life vitality, this life energy that we're aware of. If there is a way to do it, it has not surfaced to our knowledge and information, either in our work or in related work. EEG studies, for example, do show certain states of the individual's pattern of being, but they don't show that life energy in and of itself, because they are an electrical function. These all EEG electroencephalograph studies are measuring electricity, and one of the things we do know is that this particular life energy is not electricity, nor is it magnetism. We theorize that it may be the third member of a triad, and that is that, and we've noticed that in man's various parts of his culture through the many years, the triad of forces has surfaced many times, and we kind of suspect, without much more than one or two shreds of proof, that this life energy is the third in a triad of energy, that electricity is here, that magnetism is another corner of the triangle, and that this Y force, X force, Psi force, vital life energy that we call life energy, is the third point. And they do have an interrelationship, but they are not one, or they are not specifically one or the other. And just as magnetism is not electricity, but it relates to it. And so therefore we combine the two of those and we have a thing called electromagnetic energy. Somehow this life energy with which I use this now to think and to even make my tongue work is an interconnect between these two, and is a bridging, just as electromagnetic radiation is one form. We suspect that this psi force, as it were, mixed with magnetism, maybe psi magnetics or something like this, and mixed with all three produces something that we call this life energy. It's very, very tricky. It's as if you're measuring the smoke from a fire without actually measuring the fire itself, and that's the best that we can do with our instrumentation. This is one of the things that after these last 10 years, in recent years, we're quite sure of. Second thing that we have begun to perceive is, in our own direct research, is that we have one means of measuring the smoke that seems to describe or be affected by the stages of consciousness that we work in, and that is measuring body voltage. And what we do with this is that we are not measuring muscle tone or galvanic skin response. We're actually measuring body voltage by taking a head-to-foot measurement of the whole body and then running that into a very sensitive frequency counter that measures down at the microvolt level. And as near as we can figure, that voltage ranges about 1.7-something volts on the average individual, depending upon their weight and size and some other unknown factors. And down at that 1.733, that last three is where we find the sensitivity to changes in consciousness. And we can see waveforms there that are in themselves very, very interesting and very, very exciting. So as a result, this is the kind of thing that deserves much further investigation, and we certainly are working on it. We also have gotten, as you know, well into the concept of left brain and right brain, and we think that is certainly a simplification of what is really happening in the mind-brain relationship. We agree and seem to have some justification in going along in the concept that mind and mind is to brain as a ordering or command system is to a computer. We are quite definite in our approach that the mind is not the product of the brain, but the brain's more the product of the mind, as it were. And we think there are some ways that we can get that into certainly a cause and effect mode. We've also gotten to where we suspect everything is in that waveform. And as you know, quantum mechanics speaks of nothing but waveform, and holographic theory is a series of coherent waveforms. And we think that our life existence here is just a series of overlaid waveforms. The basic one, for example, the waveform is one of physical life here in and of itself. And that is basically one where you're born here and you have a long wave, and then you do what we call die, and that's one form. And when you are dead, as it were, that waveform continues, but not in this particular reality system. But it is a waveform, and you surface again and become here again and inhabit, say, a physical body, and that's the upper part of the wave. And you go down below the line again, and you inhabit and exist in some other reality structure.
Is that then what reincarnation?
Well, yes. Let me get on to that in a second, and I'll see how that might fit in reincarnation, or what we think of as reincarnation. If you take that long wave and then we add finer waves to it, and one of the most obvious ones, that wave, that big wave being birth, growth, maturity, aging, and death, and then we have another little simple waveform that we perform every day. We are awake and we're asleep. And this is a local, a little short visit to that other system. You're above the line in that waveform. You're conscious here. Go below, and you're conscious in that other reality structure. This is means, in essence, that you can't wait till you die. You got to go there during the night and get there a little bit beforehand, as it were. In other words, a balancing system. So that
are we in training then?
In training, I think it's something even beyond that. I think it's a necessity, just as an equalizing, balancing process, to be in that other reality a little bit, just to balance being in this reality. If you think of a waveform, and it's up and then it's down, it's in the mountain, the valley, or whatever way you want to put it, and so you have to have all nature. It has waveforms, and they are not in stasis. They're not all above the line. They have to be above the line and below the line to be a waveform or a vibration, as it were. And we arbitrarily set the line where we want it, but basically that's what it is. And And so you have that, and we are much inclined to go along with this because there's some supportive evidence of it. That even during this particular consciousness of which we're using right now, that there is a, and this is certainly not original with us, but there is a, I say, we like it, the idea of it, and are beginning to get pieces of it. That not only is that, here is another and much finer waveform, that as we sit here, we are flickering now in and out of that consciousness. And we are flickering in a real short, much shorter wave. What is it, a thousandth of a second, a millionth of a second, who can tell? But so that we are right now in that other reality, but we're this part of us not being able to perceive the gaps when we're in the other. He only sees the tops of the waves here. And whereas in that other system, they're saying, oh, hello, Isabel. What are you doing? Are you, and as far as Isabel's concerned, or Brian's concerned, you are living in that other reality just as much as you are here, because the flickering is going on all the time. And the fact that you can't perceive the gaps when you're there is nonetheless, we can't even perceive the gaps of going in it when we're asleep, much less these little, very hard to perceive gaps.
So we blink back and forth.
It's just that, blinking back and forth.
As you live longer and approach death, would you perhaps blink longer in the other place?
It's quite possible.
And that maybe could be what senility is?
Who knows? These are things that, yes, indeed, and these are the things that deserve to be investigated, but taking a different overview because of that. Some of the other things, incidentally, that we've gotten into, and I have fun with it because in running through the stats on these several thousand people who have been through the Gateway Program, is the universal question, why we are here. What are we doing here? And one of the ones that I enjoy very much playing with is the fact that there are not just one reason why we are here. There are a number of different reasons why we are, and each have perhaps a fundamental reason, say, to experience. But there's all these other reasons, and these, after you run a profile through that many people, you begin to perceive these differences, and they are utterly fascinating. For example, there's enough data in our files at the moment to support the theory that a certain significant percentage of people we call human have never been humans before. They've never been in a human body.
What percentage do you have?
It's around 8%, somewhere a little over 8%. Have never been a human being before. As far as we can determine by all the methods we know and others, we've come to that conclusion because they have a certain characteristic. And then we get, in exploring that characteristic, we say, well, how did they come to be humans then?
What were they before?
And what were they before? And that gets
minstrels.
And
rocks, trees, or fish.
Some of them have, and that goes back to why I come here, some evidently have never been in any physical form before, but have heard about the experience of being human and are just plain curious and have come to find out what it's like to be human. And having come for that reason, there are others who have never been in a human body or a physical body before, and they have an idea, a theory, and they like to test the theory, and the only way they could test the theory is to come be in a human body. So, pop, they come into it. Imagine their disappointments.
And somebody who keeps recycling them becomes addicted?
Now you've jumped my word, because that's exactly what it is. That's the whole thing on the whole reincarnation thing that gets so fascinating. The other part of the word, the question of why do this more than once? And it's because as we sit here right now, we can look and say, well, this lifetime I'm not going to get a chance to do that, so I need to come back and do that. I don't know as I'd want to be a female, but there are certainly things in this lifetime that I have started and I'd like to spend a whole lifetime doing. The best illustration I can give you in my own case is that if I am addicted, I'd like to come back and work with music. And work with music in physical matter, time, space, and translate what I have perceived into time, space. Maybe I'll get lazy and say, well, the heck with it, I'll just play with it where it is instead of trying to reduce it to physical matter. But the addiction concept of being in a human body, that physical matter and its intense experience, and this is seems to there's a lot that seems to support this, that being is a, in a physical body is an intense concentration of forms of energy, and they're only available in a physical body. Now, we've had other things that it's is kind of unique, the human body, because being in a crocodile body on another energy system doesn't give you certain tool-making privileges that you do when you have a physical body. And it is these types of things that are utterly, utterly fascinating when it comes to running these overall stats, why we are here, what it is, and why be in a physical body. And then there are the old hands who've recycled 10, 15, 100 times, who knows. And they're pretty easy to spot because they have a certain savvy, a certain casualness about events that doesn't disturb them. Like the, they don't get nearly as frantic about some things. And you can spot them even as little babies. You can, I know of two or three that I've seen grow up from babyhood, and they have this single pointedness that bewilders their parents totally. And the parents really can't do anything with them, but they don't have to do anything with them because these they already know. They know right where they're going, and the parents just sort of feed them and clothe them, and they go through school and they get their schooling or whatever they need in schooling, and they go on. They never because they know where they're going. And I've seen two of those grow up into maturity, and it's an astounding thing. They did know where they were going, and they did it. And they're old hands. They came here to do this. And
do those persons then have different attitudes about death? Are they more accepting about
death? I don't think they even give they don't even give death a thought. They don't even think about death. That's over here, and that'll happen when they're through doing what they have to do. Yeah. But this is a this is one of the most fascinating things that has come out of this overlay profile stuff that we've done with these people who've been in the program. And the interesting part is that you can then begin, after playing with that profile, begin to spot people in their various motivations for being, and some who also, I might add, are desperately trapped in time-space and would do anything short of the morality structure that they with which they've been imbued. They would not do those things, but they do about anything else to get permanently out of this scene. And some of them then possibly in desperation either take a long suicide route or a short suicide route. Mm-hmm. And there is much of a difference.
Why are we so specialized or localized as an awareness? Why did we choose to be this way?
Why are we specialized? I think it's principally by choice. The life pattern that you selected as a series of opportunities. And in those series of opportunities, they are predicted opportunities, but certain situations or certain events may not let you exploit that given opportunity that you thought you would have. And this, I think, is where we have turnaround problems in the expectation in that given life. I think that's quite prominent.
There's no end of probabilities as to whichever one you choose.
That's right. Yeah. But so life, you entered this particular life with a set series of opportunities that you could perceive on a probability base. The fact that they didn't turn out that way may not have been, quote, your fault or the fault of anything else except an intense system of variables. Mm-hmm. And it can be kind of...
And no matter what the probability is, it's all experience anyhow.
That's right. That's you have to get that overview. That's the other part. Overview, I think, is a key to this this whole question of research effort and the results of it. And overview is what I think we try to help people gain. And that overview has to deal with what time-space is, what it is, and not only why you're here, but what it is. Because if you obtain that, then your participation here will be much different. It'll be much more profound to you to understand it. And one of our favorite phrases developed is that time-space is local traffic. And earth living is local traffic. And so therefore we turn around and say to the individual, well, think of that and all the messy local traffic things in which are local enculturation, local superstitions, local illusions, local misconceptions, and that's all local traffic. And this is local local traffic. The earth is a backwash in the backwash of the backwash of time space. So if you think of that, and then think of what we call interstate, which is above all of that without any of the local traffic and where you can go at 55 miles an hour and faster if nobody's looking, and how much different that is and the minimal problems one encounters because the flow, you're part of a flow in one direction or the other. So that's what we like to play with. And it's very, very important to begin to get that that overview, that different state. And other thing, yeah, I keep thinking of things that I should say. One of the things that is our, with working with all participants, volunteers, and anything else, is that we have a fundamental rule, and that is that you must verify for yourself. Whatever I say, for example, is a product of my own interpretation and the interpretation of the results that we have. The results that we have achieved. So there are filtration processes that work at even at what I speak and convey to you. So therefore, we have a firm rule. Whatever I may say, whatever comes out of the Institute, whatever you get in life, in information, you have the methods, and we attempt to provide the tools with those methods to determine the reality of that. And it's up to you to verify it in your own, not take anything as valid until you know it yourself. So what I say, you can say it's interesting, and you can say, well, I believe you, but to know is something else. This is your own job.
Have you worked with any terminal cases recently?
Have we worked with any terminal cases recently? Unfortunately, no. And the reason has been principally that most terminal cases need to be working in our program, as it were, through the physician. And physicians generally don't like to have that kind of responsibility. And in a way, you can't blame them because it is an unknown factor as far as they're concerned. However, we did have an interesting opportunity, and it was during one of the and Gateway programs some months back that, and I say interesting advisedly, but here was the event. We had one program, and this woman was due to attend it, and by something that we didn't understand, in getting on or off the plane, she broke her leg. And this was up in Washington, D.C. airport that they discovered this, and so that she was taken to a hospital in Arlington with a broken leg. And she stayed there for some 6 or 7 weeks and until she could attend the next Gateway program. And then she, in turn, arrived on the scene on crutches at this following program, and a very warm and pleasant woman. I would say she was in her 50s. And as she got into the program, we put her where she didn't have to walk up and down stairs on her crutches. And as a result, she came in on a Saturday. And by Tuesday, thereabouts, we had learned that she was indeed a terminal case, that she had some form of cancer, and she had been determined to attend our Gateway program, and as a result had that's why she had stayed in the hospital instead of attempting to return to her home in the Southwest in between programs. Anyway, on about Wednesday of the program, she notified our instructor that she had to go to the hospital because of the fact that she needed a blood transfusion. And so we hustled her into the University of Virginia Hospital and installed her there, quite concerned. And that was on a Wednesday. And on a Thursday, I got in to see her. And she was in intensive care. And as a result, she was in on oxygen. And if you, she was breathing in this very deep, not quite a panting breath, but it was almost that. And in that particular mode, she was, if you didn't try to call her name or anything, she just lay there and she was dropping out and away. So I called to her and she immediately responded and we had a very pleasant conversation. And she did not appear to be in very deep pain, but the tape recorder or tape player that we had left with her was not in use because the nurses didn't know how to operate it. And she asked, would I please get it set for her? And what we had given her was a special set of tapes to use in the hospital and in intensive care. Anything they can do to help, in this case anyway, they were glad to let her have it. So it seems that the it was very simple to push one button and get the tape recorder going. And so I put the headphones on her and started to play the tape. And she looked up and thanked me very graciously with a great sense of meaning in her eyes. And at the moment the tape started, she began to breathe very easily and steadily, and as if just as if she were going to sleep. So there was no point to my sitting there much longer and holding her hand, so I gently disengaged myself and then in turn went on. I guess it was about 5 o'clock the next afternoon, the hospital called me to state that this woman, I'll call her Jane, had died just a few minutes before. I felt mixed things, of course, but certainly a little bit of sadness, and also not knowing truly how much pain she'd been in. I didn't, in turn, feel anything other than this is what was scheduled to happen. In any event, we had an exercise session about to start, so and the group here were very much aware of course that this woman was in the hospital, but they were not aware of course that she died. So I sent them into focus 12 with a very simple instruction. I said, just go and perceive what you do and what is there for you at this time. Interestingly enough, fully half of them after the session in debriefing, I reported all these different statements about this woman, Jane. One of them, for example, that she met Jane, and Jane was on the bank of a stream about to cross this bridge, and our participant tried to cross the bridge with her, and Jane said, no, you have to stay on this side because you're not ready to cross the bridge yet, but I am. And she went on. And another one reported, another of our participants reported in and said that he had met Jane and that Jane had thrown her crutches up in the air and was with this bright, joyous smile on her face, was saying, I'm free, I'm free. And there were things like that. And as a result, in looking at it from that point of view, it was quite natural that that night I went to check out on Jane myself. And in checking out with her, I did finally get in touch with her, I'll put it that way. And I found out why she had gone to the hospital, which I thought was a very touching thing. Her reason for going to the hospital was not for a blood transfusion. It's simply that she knew she was going to die, and she didn't want to embarrass us by dying here at the Institute. And that was a very
warm thing, and to have that type of consideration, because we have never had that happen. I suppose it will someday with a terminal case here, but we would like to be set up for it before it happens. So that's sort of the story of Jane and our recent terminal case. And there you have it, one report from one transducer, as it were. And much like all the others, it poses more questions than it answers. Perhaps he should write that other book. Well, this is Robert Monroe saying, I'll see you around, I hope.